You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Multiple wildfires are currently burning across the western United States, and this is forcing some evacuations. In California alone, there are more than a dozen active fires, about half ignited over the weekend. This morning, only two of the fires are at 100% level contained.
Dangerous air, the alerts for millions of Americans from the Midwest to the Northeast at this hour. The air quality in New York City, among the worst cities in the world when it comes to air quality today.
Thousands of people have been forced to flee villages in southwest France as huge wildfires continue to burn, the worst in 80 years. The French Prime Minister has described the scene as a catastrophe on an unprecedented scale. In fact, across Europe so far this year, there have been close to 1,500 wildfires. That's 40% more than last year. The French government believes the increase is linked to global warming.
Deadly heat wave sparks wildfires in Turkey and beyond.
A brutal heat wave is scorching parts of West Asia, pushing temperatures to dangerous new extremes. In Iraq, thermometers hit a staggering 52 degrees Celsius this week. Power outages have left many without electricity, no fans, no air conditioning, just dry air and burning streets.
Wildfires across Turkey, fanned by strong winds, have spread to residential areas in the western province of Izmir and elsewhere. More than 50,000 people have been evacuated from their homes.
We're caught in a fire, climbing fire.
Hundreds of millions of people suffer as wildfire smoke fills cities this summer. The smallest, most deadly particles drift inside homes and business. New science reveals what is in that smoke, from heavy metals to exotic chemicals, some leading to brain damage and early death. Toxic smoke, analysis and interviews with experts in this special edition of Radio EcoShock. Heat, smoke, and drowning rain spread across the world again last week. On August 7th, Phoenix, Arizona set a new August record of 118 degrees Fahrenheit, 47.7 C. Turkey experienced a record-breaking heat wave with temperatures reaching 50.5 degrees Celsius. That's 122.9 Fahrenheit. That was in Silopi, a town in the southeast. This surpasses the previous national record of 49.5 degrees Celsius set in August 2023, according to Reuters. The extreme heat has led to wildfires and forced evacuations in some regions, with firefighters battling blazes for several days. Cyprus fires resulted in a new record for the highest annual cumulative wildfire emissions in 2 days, and Greece was burning again. Tourists hoping to escape the heat in northern Finland were in for a surprise. Even in Lapland, temperatures were above 30 degrees C, 86 Fahrenheit. Crazy for that place, and it lasted for 22 straight days, with tropical nights to boot. There was no escaping the heat in all Scandinavia. Also last week, Japan suffered through its hottest day on record, with mercury reaching 41.8 degrees C, that's 107 Fahrenheit, plus the humidity. Hospitals filled up with heat victims. In Korea, The Guardian reports, overnight temperatures in Seoul stayed above 25 C, 77 Fahrenheit, for 22 consecutive days in July, meteorological officials said, the longest period since modern weather records were first kept in 1907, end quote. According to Yale Climate Connections, 4 billion people experienced a whole extra month of extreme heat in the past year, and that is the direct result of human-caused climate change. California is also burning again, with serious fires around Santa Barbara and up the coast. The Canyon Fire exploded over 5,000 fires in one night. In Arizona, at the north rim of the Dragon Bravo fire. It burned more than 133,000 acres, becoming the largest in the country and still going, still out of control as we go to the air. According to the EU Copernicus Eye in the Sky satellite service, in July, wildfires in Arizona emitted a total of 1.5 megatons of carbon emissions, the highest level for the month in CAM's records. Meanwhile, wildfire emissions in New Mexico were the third highest on record for July. The UK recorded its highest annual total wildfire emissions following large wildfires in northern Scotland at the end of June. Meanwhile, France has its largest wildfire since 1949, burning 16,000 hectares of forest at this count, an area 1.5 times the size of Paris. The French Prime Minister called it a catastrophe on an unprecedented scale, and he blamed global warming.
Too close to home.
As I nervously sent out last week's show, worried about wildfire, this happened. That was the closest lightning strike in my long life. It shook the windows and walls, and it shook me. The temperature dropped 20 degrees Fahrenheit, 11 degrees C in minutes. As I looked out my window, another orange bolt struck the hillside directly across from our home. It instantly started a grass fire and a brush fire, a circle of bright flames expanding on all sides. Minutes later, we heard a big diesel fire engine start up in our volunteer fire hall. Then it got stranger. We live in a so-called pocket desert in southern British Columbia. We get lightning, but it is almost always dry lightning with no rain. In fact, our province was hit by over 40,000 lightning strikes in that two-day period. But this time, a miracle happened. The dark cloud burst open and heavy rain came down, putting out the fire that threatened us with evacuation and maybe even losing our home. That makes an impression. It makes me even more dedicated to the climate fight and to this show. This year in Southeast BC, we almost got away with no wildfire smoke, even as Canada heads into another record-smashing year for wildfires. Millions of Canadians are smoked out. In Fort Mac in northern Alberta, it was almost dark at noon and totally toxic. On the air quality scale, where 50 is good and 100 signals danger, Jeff Masters reports the AQI hit 2,242 in Fort Mac. That's at least 10 times higher than the hazardous level. Since the start of the year, Copernicus reports, the cumulative total estimated emissions for Canada is 180 megatons of carbon, already making it one of the top three extreme wildfire years in the 23 years that CAMS has kept records, end quote. The American media blames Canada for dangerous smoke from the U.S. Midwest to the East Coast. Chicago and New York were among the most polluted cities in the world for a few days. But people continued to work and play outside, unaware of the risk to their health now and in the future. Most media warnings say people with certain health conditions and infants need to be cautious during wildfire smoke events. As usual, mainstream media is discounting the real risks to everyone. Absolutely everyone is at risk when breathing wildfire smoke. During smoke, athletes and muscle men can and do drop dead from heart attacks or strokes. Everyone may add to their cancer risk burden with heavy metals and other toxic materials, even from so-called natural fires in Canada's far north. Tiny particles in wildfire smoke can cross the blood barrier, and it is known for brain damage, including increasing the risk of dementia. We'll hear more about that later. We still don't know the true toll of wildfire smoke. Doctors often leave those details out of death certificates, noting heart attack as the cause of death, for example. It is hard to know the long-term toll, especially as the greatest harms come to people at the bottom of the social order, like outdoor farm workers, and even more to people in developing countries, where no records are kept, no studies are done, and there's little media coverage. I will pass on the numbers I managed to find and the sources.
Protect yourself.
Self-protection is possible for many of us. First, stay inside. Yes, smoke will penetrate almost any building, but amounts will be much less. Then, if you can, put up a second layer of defense, install a portable HEPA air filter, and keep it where you or loved ones are. These filters are very effective at protecting your lungs, organs, and brain. If you must go outside, do it for short periods of time and wear an N95 mask. They work. If traveling by bicycle or motorcycle, you need specialized breathing filters as you scoop up more from the air. Protect your eyes as well.
What microparticles look like.
It helps to picture what tiny microparticles are to fully understand their nature. There are almost countless different compositions forming tiny particles from wildfires. Placed on a human hair and seen with a microscope, you might be able to see them as blackish dots. We imagine these particles as flattish flecks, but they are not. Picture instead a traveling asteroid with bulges and holes in it. It accumulates other ultrafine particles, from toxic chemicals to heavy metals or bacteria, so it's a combination that can go into our lungs and into the bloodstream, even by your nose into the brain. This is what PM 2.5 and its smaller cousins represent. All of this comes as superfires burn in many countries and extreme heat waves set up the rest.
What is in the wildfire smoke?
According to New Science, published April 2025, wildfire smoke can contain carbon monoxide, nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, methane, non-methane organic compounds, lead, and ozone, all emitted directly from the fires. In the atmosphere, chemical interaction with wildfire smoke leads to further toxins like peroxacetyl nitrate and secondary organic aerosols. The scientists left out mercury, which can rise up in wildfire smoke from industrial sites and forest floors. Mercury causes Minamata disease, numbing of the limbs and death, as well as heritable birth defects.
Raising radiation.
The scientists also left out radiation. Fires burning from former nuclear accident sites like Chernobyl or Fukushima release more radioactive materials years later, even decades after the fire. This was a concern in 2010 when wildfires around Chernobyl launched more radiation into the air. Fortunately, that did not reach Europe. It was kind of localized. Some of the radioactive particles from four nuclear reactors that blew up Fukushima, Japan, landed in the United States all the way to Pennsylvania. Now these can be carried up again in forest fires. Radioactivity can also be raised with fire smoke from improperly stored nuclear sites, and possibly if an operating or mothballed nuclear power plant is burned over. Still, overall, this radiation is a rare risk compared to the guaranteed threat of negative impacts of breathing heavy wildfire smoke.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
What is all this wildfire smoke doing to our health? Here is Dr. Michael Brower speaking on health impacts and personal protection during smoke events. I recorded Michael in Vancouver at the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences meeting, February 19th, 2012.
Radio EcoShock.
Fire smoke travels huge distances, sometimes smudging out part of a continent. In the soot below, human lungs don't do very well. As we'll hear from our third speaker, hundreds of thousands of humans die every year from inhaling smoke from natural and agricultural fires. But first, you should hear this Canadian medical expert, Dr. Mike Brower. He explains big advances in predicting the smoke plumes, so people with breathing difficulties can be warned and do something about it. It's almost like tornado warnings, only more accurate. Pharmacies can know when to stock up on inhalers, and Brower ends up with tips you can use to protect yourself if smoke fills up your air. Here is Mike Brower addressing a special session of the American Academy in February 2012.
I'm going to talk about health impacts of fire smoke. Most people thinking about fires and health actually think about property damage, direct influences of the fires themselves. But there is now quite a bit of evidence of impacts of smoke. And really, when we actually think about air pollution episodes in developed countries, we have done a pretty good job of dealing with extremes in air pollution in urban areas due to industrial emissions, traffic-related emissions. We still have sort of chronic exposure to pollutants from those sources. But really, one of the major, if not the major source of episodes of air pollution in developed countries are fire smoke. So in a location that's impacted by a fire smoke, that's almost certainly going to be the highest concentrations that that population will experience that year. So just a little bit of background to put this in perspective, what do we know about air pollution and health? And specifically, I'm going to focus mostly on airborne particulate matter. This is the heart of the air pollution that we have the strongest associations with population health impacts. From studies that have been done now in over 400 cities in the world, we know that on days with the worst air pollution, more people die. So daily changes lead to more deaths. It's important to consider air pollution for any one individual. The individual risk is very small, but what makes it important from a public health perspective is that everybody is exposed. So the population impact can be very large. So everybody always asks me, you know, can you see a patient, you know, can you see air pollution disease? No, we can't. It's a contributing risk factor. But when we do these statistical associations, we can actually estimate the population impact. And you can contrast that with something like smoking, where we know the risk to an individual is very large. But fortunately, in a country like Canada, actually the population exposure to smoke, the proportion of the population that smokes is rather low and decreasing. That's a good thing. We also know that in more polluted areas, people die earlier than in less polluted areas. And the evidence base for that is somewhat smaller. We don't have 400 studies, but we have in the hundreds and 100 or so studies like that. This figure here is just to illustrate, if we're talking about something like death, which is very easy to understand, that's really sort of a tip of the iceberg phenomenon. The proportion of the population that may experience death as a result of air pollution, whether that's chronic exposure or an episode situation, is rather small. But underlying that are a whole other series of health impacts that actually affect a greater proportion of the population. And in some cases, these actually add up to sort of contribute to earlier death. So I'm actually going to be focusing on sort of two indicators that we've primarily used in our forest fire smoke work, and that will be a visit to a general practitioner and medication use. So these are things that sort of affect a somewhat larger proportion of the population, therefore easier to detect. And that's important when we talk about forest fires, because often they don't actually impact large urban areas. So in order to get the statistical power to actually detect these sort of risks of air pollution exposure, we need large populations or sort of long time series of data in order to identify something like a death. Forest fires sometimes impact smaller communities, rural areas, and so we like some kind of an indicator that we're more likely to see a signal. So what do we actually know about fire smoke? This is just a quote from a review a number of us did several years ago, which is actually looking at sort of biomass smoke in general, whether it was burning in fires, burning from agricultural land clearing, from actually burning wood for heating or cooking. And when we sort of looked at all the evidence, basically we see sort of a number of respiratory outcomes, symptoms, hospital admissions, emergency room visits for respiratory disease, some clinical measures like decreased lung function, very consistent associations with increased levels of particulate matter in the air. And a number of studies suggest that asthmatics are a particularly susceptible subpopulation with respect to smoke exposure. Here's just one example of a study that we did focusing on the 2003 fires. Don't really need to do any statistics to look at this. This is showing the difference in weekly physician visits compared to a long-term mean, and the difference in weekly levels of particulate matter in the air, again, compared to a long-term mean. And you can really see quite clearly, although there's some variability, when the levels of particulate matter increase, and this is all due to the fires, smoke from the fires. You saw this increase in weekly visits to physicians, and this is actually specific for asthma. If you look at actually some other outcome, we looked at mental illness type visits, anxiety type visits. You don't see any relationship there. This is the other indicator I mentioned to you. This is looking at filled prescriptions for inhalers, reliever medication. And again, in these regions, we know quite well that when particulate matter gets, the mean levels are somewhere around 10 or even lower micrograms per cubic meter. When it gets above 25, certainly, so any of these blue lines, this is fire. So really, we're starting to see a signal here that we can actually think about using even for surveillance. But what we know about forest fires is that often they impact rural areas and smaller communities where there's no monitoring available. So in order to have a complete picture of the system, we need to actually think about ways to go beyond air monitoring. And this is relevant for Canada, it's relevant for British Columbia, which is a place that actually has very dense monitoring. We have some communities in British Columbia, populations less than 5,000 people, where there's a regular air monitoring, which is actually unprecedented in the world. There are many cities in the world, the populations of 1 million people, where there's no air monitoring. So we actually want to think about tools that are useful for us here, but also are applicable elsewhere in the world. In fact, the majority of the world where there is no air monitoring. Another thing that's important about looking beyond ground-based air monitoring data is that monitors actually may not function during extreme episodes. So we have several examples, and I'll show you a few, but certainly in the fires that affect Southern California, where, again, a very dense monitoring system, but the monitors all fail during fire events. So they become overloaded, break down, and even in very extreme fires, you may lose power, for example, so the monitors don't function. It's sort of the worst scenario that your system that you're using to tell you about air quality and smoke may not function when you actually need it the most. So in order to mount a public health response, we'd like at least real-time information. Ideally, we even like forecasting these events. So we've been using actually for a number of years some remote sensing approaches and sort of seeing how well they can actually predict health responses. So we thought about that and we thought, well, maybe now when we have some smoke forecasting tools, which we do now have, actually did those predict health response? And that's what these smoke forecasting tools should be doing if they're going to be useful. So fortunately, over the last several years, a large group has sort of brought more or less a U.S. system into Canada and adapted it to a Canadian data sources. This is called Blue Sky, the Blue Sky smoke forecasting system. We now have forecasts that are developed up to 60 hours in advance of where smoke will travel throughout Western Canada, and includes sort of northwestern, all the way to northwestern Ontario, the Yukon, Northwest Territories, Nunavut, and the U.S. border states. It's on roughly a 10 by 10 kilometer grid cell. So that's the spatial resolution of the predictions. And they're predicted, we get hourly predictions up to 60 hours in advance for ground level concentrations.
If you've just tuned in, this is Dr. Michael Brower, a Canadian-based expert on the impacts of fire smoke, recorded by Radio EcoShock.
So now I'm going to move to sort of what about health impacts? How well does this forecasting tool predict health impacts? So if we have a forecasting system that actually seems to predict health impacts, the next thing we'd like to do is actually give some public health guidance. And there's actually a very good document that I helped work on a number of years ago, and I would say it's really still current, that was put out by the states of California and Washington. So if any of you are interested in sort of public health response, there's the link for that. Some of the things that are recommended are room air cleaners, and I just want to show you some data from a study. Another one of my students did a number of years ago, where Prabhjit Barn did, where we actually chased fires, and when we got to a community that was impacted by fire smoke, she found volunteers and she put air cleaners in their homes and measured the levels of particulate matter inside their homes, which is actually where people spend most of their time. So these are concentrations without the air cleaner, and these are concentrations with the air cleaner, both sort of 24-hour measurements, how much smoke actually infiltrates. So it's adjusted for whatever the outdoor concentration is. You can see that, and these are, again, all homes impacted by fire smoke. So depending on the home, and there's a little bit of air here, but up to sort of 100% of the smoke can infiltrate. down to 20-25%, depending on whether they open windows or not, whether they have air conditioning, how tightly the home is sealed just due to its construction. So there's a lot of variability in homes. But in essentially all cases, when you operated this air cleaner, you dropped the level of particulate matter indoors. And on average, there is a 65% decrease in indoor fire smoke when you operated one of these air cleaners. And I'll point out, these are relatively inexpensive, $100 to $200. They're really not, they basically have a pleated paper filter inside and a fan that's pumped. So as long as they're sized appropriately for the room, essentially it's drawing in dirty air and cleaning out the particulate matter. Really very effective in terms of reducing the smoke levels. We weren't able to measure health impacts in this study because we never knew where the fires were going to be. But in a subsequent study in wood-burning communities, so it's a little bit different type of pollution, it's a more predictable exposure. We did exactly the same kind of study, randomized, actually blinded to the participants, and we saw, again, these decreases in indoor concentrations of particulate matter, and also saw improvements in a number of measures of health, so improvements in inflammatory responses, measures of blood vessel function. So it really looks like these filters improve air quality, and you get a health benefit for that. So that's exactly what we'd like to see and what we'd like to recommend to people. Some other things that are recommended are, well, air conditioning does a similar thing. We'd like to see communities, and this has been done in some parts of British Columbia, establish clean air shelters. So communities that are likely to be impacted by forest fire smoke have sort of a smoke response plan. So just like we do in heat events, we have cool air shelters, we can have clean air shelters. And it really could be something, any type of structure where there's a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system where you can put in some level of filtration. Could be a school, could be a shopping mall, it doesn't have to be anything fancy. Outdoor workers, people who have to be outdoors, are probably the only population that we'd recommend wearing a respirator. When I first started working on fire smoke, it was in Southeast Asia in this episode that you've heard about in 1997. And everybody was sort of grabbing these air filters. In fact, these respirators depleted the world supply of them. But we saw very clearly that they weren't providing any protection. So you saw babies wearing them, and the air, you know, air goes through the path of least resistance, which is right around this. I saw people sort of going outside of a building, putting it over like this, and then taking it off when they got in their cars, you know, and there's just as much smoke inside their cars. So it really provides a false sense of security. It's probably doing more harm than good. Very importantly, you can see that link to medication use. We've seen some examples where pharmacies will actually deplete their supply if they're not prepared. So we'd like to actually see pharmacies be prepared in terms of having enough medication. Individuals, before fire season, actually meeting with their healthcare practitioners to sort of set up a plan, making sure they have enough medication so we don't have to see a rush to the physician actually during an event, which is actually when we want people probably to be staying inside or staying in protected area, especially if you're imagining someone with chronic lung disease, even exerting themselves is really a challenge. And then in the more extreme situations, evacuation. And I think Mike mentioned earlier that evacuations are sort of, often we evacuate people because of smoke. It's very expensive. We have communities where we actually fly in Hercules transports and fly out the whole community. Certainly, we'd like to know from forecasting whether we should do that or not. But ideally, we'd like to avoid that and only use that as a last resort. So really trying to combine all this information with the forecast, we can, I think, give better advice. Thank you.
That was Dr. Michael Brower at the AAAS meeting. In the leading science journal PNAS, Lynn Peoples wrote an article, How Air Pollution Threatens Brain Health. She describes how tiny particles from wildfire smoke reach our brains. Quote, metal-toting particles that reach the brain can directly damage neurons. Both the particles themselves and their toxic hitchhikers can also cause widespread harm by dysregulating the activation of microglia, the immune cells in the brain. Microglia may mistake the intruders for pathogens, releasing chemicals to try to kill them. Those chemicals can accumulate and trigger inflammation, and chronic inflammation in the brain has been implicated in neurodegeneration. Particles may also affect the brain via the bloodstream. Research shows that small particles can slip through the plasma membrane through the membrane of alveoli, the tiny air sacs in the lungs and get picked up in the capillaries. The particles are then distributed around the body in the blood. Although some of these particles may eventually reach the blood-brain barrier, a pollutant need not enter the brain to cause trouble there. The immune system can react to particles in the lung or bloodstream too, triggering widespread inflammation that affects the brain. End quote from Lynn Peoples and Pinas, June 3, 2020. Get a link to